1,000 French Canadians in the city. After Father Chevalier's coming and the opening of the first church in 1873, immigration was speeded up for a while, as many as 5 or 6 families arriving on the Canadian train, the Train du Canada, every day.
Millwork was hard, the hours were long, and the conditions were sometimes dangerous. The pay was not enormous, but the large number of Franco-Americans, coupled with the determination to preserve their heritage in an English-speaking country, led to a vibrant and tight-knit community whose influence we can still see across New Hampshire today. Today on The Exchange, the history of French Canadians in the Granite State. And let's hear from you, too. Did you or do you have relatives who came from New Hampshire from Quebec? If so, what do you know or what would you like to know about their stories? Where do you see influence of Franco-Americans in New Hampshire today, and how has that influence affected who we are as Granite Staters? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post comments on our Facebook page. Our guest today is Robert Perrault. He's a writer, historian, and French teacher at St. Anselm College. His new book is Franco-American Life and Culture in Manchester, New Hampshire, Vive la Difference. Robert, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It seems like the key to understanding Franco-Americans and their history in New Hampshire is this concept of la survivance. Can you explain that for us a little bit?
La survivance, it means survival and actually cultural survival. It was something that was born out of the conquest of Quebec by the English on the Plains of Abraham in 1759. When the English conquerors took over, they decided that French Canadians, who were also Catholics, would become English speakers and Protestants. And the French Canadians said, no way, we are French Catholics. We will continue speaking French and we'll continue being Catholic. And so they resisted. And out of that whole resistance was born that whole ideology of la survivance. We're going to survive as who we are. And so the English, after a while, just kind of gave it up and let them be.
And central to that, as you mentioned, was language. I won't try to do the French version of it, but one of the sayings is, he who loses his language loses his faith.
Yes, qui perd sa langue perd sa foi.
Merci.
De rien.
So when does this movement to New Hampshire really start? Families and individuals coming from Quebec, and why?
Well, for the most part, as I said, they were disfavored by the English. The English said, well, if you're going to be second-class citizens in your country, you will not, you just won't be able to have the same privileges, the same economic advantages that the English had. And so, and the English, for the most part, by the way, tended to live in the larger cities, Montreal, Quebec City, and also in the eastern townships. They settled in certain small towns. The French were pretty much rural. They were left to themselves as farmers, and farming was not conducive to a good life. The soil was bad. There wasn't enough land to feed everyone. And I should mention the concept that the French themselves started, this revanche du berceau, revenge of the cradle. They said, if we can't conquer the English, politically and economically, we can outnumber them.
and have more babies.
And they had more babies. Of course, the more babies you have, the more land you need to grow vegetables and whatnot to feed them. And there just wasn't enough land. And so little by little, people began to move to that great, that great country that everyone was moving to from Europe as well, because it was going on from Europe as well. So
in some sense, there's a commonality with people who came from Europe in that they had there were the cultural issues of, the tension between the French speakers and the English speakers. And there was also the economic incentive to try to make some money in a place where there was a job available, as opposed to trying to make a very difficult living on the farm. But at the same time, there's a big difference, and I'm talking about geography. Whereas Europeans are coming over, and oftentimes the perception, at least, was, I'm not going to be coming back to this part of the world again. I am making a clean start here in the New World. Whereas many of these people coming from Quebec are coming in the 19th century, they're coming by train. And so there was some access to go back north and see the old part, the old places again.
Exactly. And in the early days, in fact, many of these people were coming down temporarily just to make some money to try to revive their farms. And so sometimes the father and some of the older sons would come down, work in the mills, you know, in the wintertime, because in the wintertime, obviously, you're not farming. You did have the option of going north. Sometimes they would say, go north and be a logger up in the logging camps. But that wasn't much of a life. And so they'd come down to New England instead. And so really, unlike Europeans, the French Canadians could, I say, you know, kind of re-bathe in that French language and culture and renew themselves. And so the language, with the ideology of survivance to begin with, plus the geography, you have them keeping their language and culture much longer than Europeans, who are cut off from their...
Sometimes you hear today when someone comes to America and only stays for a few years, makes some money, and then returns back to a home country. There's a bit of a tension here that you hear sometimes from Americans who are here full time, for lack of a better term, that, you know, they're just coming in to make a little bit of money. They're not necessarily giving back. You know, they're just sort of taking advantage of the situation. Was there any feeling like that in the 19th century when people were coming in for just a very short period of time and always with the intention to return to Quebec?
There was definitely that feeling. In fact, there was even that same feeling within the Franco-American community, because there were some who were coming here permanently, and they were becoming citizens and participating in the political process and the economic process, whereas others who were just going back and forth like that. In fact, there was a journalist, and I write about him in my book here, Ferdinand Gagnon, who he founded the very first French-language newspaper in New Hampshire, La Voix du Peuple, The Voice of the People. It only lasted for 7 months in 1869, and that was in Manchester. He moved on to Worcester, Massachusetts, and founded several other papers, including Le Travailleur, The Laborer, in which he advocated two ideas here. One was naturalization. He said, if you're going to stay, then become citizens and participate in political and economic life. If you're not, then go back home. And so he advocated for repatriation. And he was even backed by the Quebec government, which was seeing its population being bled. You know, between 1866 and 1875, some 50,000 per year were leaving Quebec to come to some part of the United States. You know, we talk here about New Hampshire and New England, but there were many who were going out to the Midwest. Those who didn't want to work in mills would go out to the Midwest and become farmers there, trying it in what they perceived as perhaps better soil and better conditions. So you've got all these, you know, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, other states that had Franco-American populations as well. So Gagnon was advocating both of these ideas simultaneously. In fact, he participated in the founding of a town. If you go to northern New Hampshire, to Pittsburgh, and you cross the border, the first town in is called Chartierville. The second town is called La Patrie, which means the homeland. That is an artificially created town by the Quebec government to offer free land to any immigrant in the United States who wanted to go back and, you know, try farming all over again. And Gagnon even repatriated his own parents, but he stayed in Worcester.
So this is another generational conflict, yeah, I guess, in play. Yeah. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Franco-American scholar Robert Perreault about the history of French Canadians in the Granite State. Arguably, no other culture has had as much of an influence on New Hampshire as Franco-Americans. We're looking at why they came, where they settled, and the idea of la survivance, which kept their culture alive and well in cities like Manchester, Nashua, and Berlin. And let's get your calls and ideas into the mix. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. 800-892-6477. NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You talked about this a minute ago, Robert, the idea that there were people coming from Quebec to all parts of New England and then even beyond. What would draw people specifically to New Hampshire, to Manchester, or to the northern forests?
Well, northern forests, obviously more logging, but in perhaps better weather conditions than way up in Quebec, Berlin being the main place for logging. But most people were coming to places like Manchester, Nashua, Laconia, Lebanon, Keene, all the cities, the seacoast cities, Dover, Rochester, Somersworth, to work in textile mills and shoe shops. That's where they could make money. You know, on farms, you never knew you could work and your crops could fail, your animals could die or be sick or whatever. And in mills, you knew that however hard the work was, you knew you were going to get a pay at the end of the week or the end of the 2 weeks, whatever.
And we'll pick up after a short break with what life in the mills and life in those cities was like for the Franco-American community. That's coming up after a short break on The Exchange. Remember, you can add your questions and comments into the conversation. Call us at 1-800-892-6477 or email us at exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and more on conscientious consumerism on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, tax rates and the presidential campaign. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly sunny statewide with a chance of an afternoon shower for the North Country. Highs around 75 from the White Mountains north and along the seacoast. Around 80 in the Lakes region, Mount Washington Valley, Upper Valley area, Monadnock region, and Merrimack Valley. And around 85 degrees in southern parts of the state. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Capital Well Clean Water Center, serving New Hampshire with installations and service of efficient, renewable geothermal energy systems. Details on geothermal at capitalwell.com. And from Holloway Motor Cars of Manchester, authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer, featuring the new C-Class Coupe, driving ambition in high definition. Online at benzcars.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Canoy. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the story of Franco-Americans in the Granite State. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page and join the conversation there. Our guest today is Robert Perrault. He's a writer and historian and a French teacher at St. Anselm College. He's the author of the book Franco-American Life and Culture in Manchester, New Hampshire, Vive la Difference. We were just talking before the break about people coming from Quebec to come work at the mills in New Hampshire. And we all have a general idea of the difficult life of a mill worker. But what was a typical day like for a worker in one of these mills?
Well, first of all, I have a chapter in the book which compares a woman on the farm in Quebec and a woman in the mills. And so I say on the farm, she lived in a small village where she and her family owned land. They owned the house. They owned the crops that they grew and the animals that they had. Everything is done from the land. Everything's done for the family. It's subsistence farming. She makes her own hours. If she wants to take a break, she can take a break. The air is clean. The environment is quiet. There's not a lot of noise and this and that. Everyone in the village is French Catholic. So, you know, everyone has pretty much the same outlook and the same traditions and whatnot. She moves to a place like Manchester or Dover or Rochester or Keene or whatever, and suddenly it's no longer that. She now lives in an apartment rather than owning, so she doesn't own land, she doesn't own a house. She's no longer her own boss. There's a mill bell that rings to summon her to work 6 in the morning to 6 at night. If she wants to take a break, she has to ask the boss. It's noisy. I don't know if you've ever been in a weave room, but you hear those 1,000 looms going click, clack, click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. It's deafening. She's breathing cotton dust all the time, which can lead to brown lung. It's humid. It's hot. It has to be, for cotton especially, okay? And in the summer, it's horrible. That's basically it. What, you know, children working too. That's another thing I should mention. Children worked on the farm, but children also worked in the mills. And we think of that today as absolutely horrible by our standards. But in those days, that's just the way it was. Children had small fingers, small hands, so they could do certain operations that adults couldn't do. But children were also sometimes, you know, mischievous, and around machinery that didn't always work. So there were fingers lost and limbs lost, and it was horrible. And the compensation in those days was nothing what it is today. So,
and at the end of the day, you'd go to sleep and start all over again the next day.
That's it. 72 hours a week in the early days. They'd work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Eventually, it got cut down, and little by little, as people organized, they would be able to cut the hours. They got it down to 48 hours for the most part.
I was very shocked when I saw this in the book, that you said, of course, that children were some of the people working in these mills, but also that their parents sometimes were the ones training them. And sort of by our, you know, our modern perceptions, you would think, well, it's horrible enough that the kids would be there, much less that their parents would be the ones training them. But there was actually an idea behind that.
Well, the whole idea was, children, obviously, if they're learning from their parents, you know, first of all, on the farm, as I said, children worked on the farm. They were learning there from their parents. So you're just transferring that idea into an urban industrial setting. So it's a child would feel much more comfortable learning from his or her father, mother, aunt, uncle, whatever, than learning from a stranger. So that's kind of how they... It was a way to control, too. In fact, there was another aspect of control, and that was those workers who would learn English well enough and were skilled well enough would sometimes be promoted to a small boss, not big boss there, but small boss. And that was a way to control the workers as well. You know, you'd have the big bosses telling the little bosses what they needed to have their workers do, and they would those bosses were bilingual, those small bosses, so they could, in other words, if a big boss gave an order in English to a worker, the worker might not quite understand and do it wrong or just resist doing it, whereas if the small boss is one of your people who's speaking your language, you'd be more likely to cooperate. And so there was that control as well.
Was it also a case, I mean, you can see sort of the advantage of having someone able to speak in a worker's native language and explain a task to them, but was it also advantageous for the mill owners and the mill management to be able to say, you know, it's almost a little dissension in the ranks then if you have, you know, one of your people who had previously been thought of as labor to now be in somewhat of a position of authority, and you start to think, well, is that guy really on my side or is he on the boss's side?
I'm sure it created some sort of tension there, but I think in general it worked, though, because it was something that continued to be practiced throughout the years. And eventually, with time, some even did make it up to a bigger boss. I know there was the founding president of the ACA, which was l'Association Canado-Américaine, a French fraternal insurance society. He was the first president, named Théophile Biron. He was an overseer of weaving in the Amiskig mills. In fact, he was the first Franco-American to be named an overseer. So that was big stuff.
Let's hear from one of our listeners now who's calling from Manchester. It's Steve. Steve, thanks for calling. You are on The Exchange.
Oh, good morning. I've been sitting here listening to your guest speaking the phrases and then French names, and they seem to be pronounced in French. my experience living in Manchester for about 8 years is that nobody speaks French pronunciation. It's all English, and it's not French names. You know, Gagnon. It's all English pronunciation, and just to my ear, it sounds really grating. And I'm wondering why the pronunciations have not been kept. Were they marginalized? And I'm just sensitive to it because I lived for a few years in New Brunswick, Canada. And whether you were a French speaker or English speaker, it didn't matter. If it was a French word or a name, you always pronounced it in the French manner, you know, French pronunciation.
Great question.
I'm wondering why that hasn't happened here.
Great question, Steve. And you did mention, you know, the founder of the first French language newspaper, his last name is Gagnon.
Yeah,
and today that might be pronounced Gagnon in Manchester.
Yes, it might. And I think it's basically just an evolution. People are losing, I always say, with every generation, they put a little bit more American water in their French wine. So they're losing the language, and at the same time, they're losing the ability to pronounce even names. I mean, I know as a teacher myself, I have students who come to class, and they'll tell me, you know, my name is Joe Gagnon. And I'll say, well, in my class, you're Joseph Gagnon. And they'll say, well, I should know how to pronounce my name. Come on. And I'd say, yeah, you should, but you don't. So... It's just, to me, it's something that it's not that difficult, really. It really isn't that difficult. I mean, even if you can't speak the language, at least learn to pronounce the names. But it's something that's been forgotten over the years, and now it's just a practice. It's just people do it that way, and that's it. So, I mean, you just call me, Robert Perrault, but I'm Robert Perrault. That's who I am, and when I introduce myself, usually I'll do both, you know.
Right.
French and English, because we are bilingual. So
I'll have to work on that. Steve, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to ask a question, it's 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. But this idea of language and pronunciation really gets back to what we were talking about before, la survivance, and this is what people coming into Manchester were worried was going to happen, that their culture was going to start to anglicize and start to dissipate in a way. And part of how they dealt with that was creating a neighborhood within the city, a kind of a Le Petit Canada, I think, is what it was called.
Yeah, you said it correctly.
I'm getting good.
Le Petit Canada, yeah, Little Canada. And this was happening everywhere, by the way, all throughout New England, these Little Canadas, which had various institutions that were devoted toward keeping the language and culture. So you had the church, you had the school, you had the newspaper, you had clubs and societies, and of course the neighborhood itself, everyone living together, and you know, children would play outside and they'd be speaking French amongst themselves, and they'd go to school. And of course in school it had to be bilingual, because the state of New Hampshire, or whichever state they happen to be in, would always require the schools to teach certain subjects in English. That was by law. So all, you know, English grammar and spelling and reading and writing and history and math and science, those kinds of courses would always be taught in English. And then with the rest of the school day, you would have in, say, public schools or maybe the English Catholic schools, English language Catholic schools, you might have art, you might have music, you might have gym or whatever. And instead, we had French. So we had la grammaire, grammar, épellation, spelling, lecture, reading, and the most important subject, le catéchisme, catechism. That was the raison d'être, the reason for being for those schools, was to teach us catechism in French, because religion, remember that saying that qui perd sa langue perd sa foi, he who loses his language loses his faith. So that was very, very big. That was drummed into us just as much as those French verb conjugations.
And when you say us, you're including yourself personally.
Oh, yes.
Because you attended one of these schools.
I attended, yes, St. George Grammar School in Manchester, L'École Saint-Georges, class of 1965. In fact, my class was the last graduating class that went through the old parochial system of half day of French, half day of English, wherein you were expected to show up in first grade at age 6, perfectly bilingual. And so you were there for just to learn to read and write the two languages that you were supposed to already possess. The year after I graduated, in the fall of 65, they began teaching French at St. George as a second language. In other words, you know, there were kids coming in whose French was not as, you know, right up there, so they had to have some remedial work. And then the school closed in 1970. In fact, my sister was in the last graduating class of all, 1970.
Let's take another call. This is Paula calling from Laconia. Hi, Paula. You're on the Exchange.
Yes, hi. I was listening to you explain the experiences of a young woman either in Quebec on the farm versus in Manchester in the mills. And I thought that that was quite a romanticized view of what happens on the farms. The difference that I always heard growing up, because I come from a French-Canadian family, my father was actually born in Quebec City, was that they came because the young women came for a sense of liberty. When they were teenagers, they were pretty much working on the farm without any kind of autonomy. You say they worked, you know, 16 hours a day on the farm. Well, actually, they worked at the beck and call of the men in the family, whether it was the father or their husband later. There was no such thing as time off when you're a mother and a wife. They wanted to get some kind of liberty. And when you talk about they owned the land, well, that was primogeniture. If you were the man, the oldest son, you inherited the land. If you didn't, you didn't own the land. And when you come down to work in the factory and you talked about the clipping of the machines and all that, well, there was absolute boredom up there with no sounds in the villages. So these women came down, and, I mean, there are still people's great-grandmothers and grandmothers in Manchester who will tell you that they preferred coming down. They worked hard. They produced families afterwards. They worked hard. I mean, there was no birth control for such a long time, but at least they felt that there was a future for them. And so I just wanted to make that comment because I thought that was quite a fantasy when you were talking about how wonderful the farms were.
Paula, thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, Paula, actually, I didn't really try to romanticize the farm. In fact, they left the farm to come to the city, and most people ended up staying. I was just trying to describe what life was like on the farm for them, and it's true that they did achieve more liberty here. So I'm not trying to say that they were prisoners. I'm just saying, what's the difference? There was a lot of culture shock. You know, you've got to imagine, when I say it was quiet on the farm and that sort of thing, imagine yourself coming to a city where there's just a lot of noise, these gigantic mill buildings. You know, you've never seen anything like this before. In fact, most of the people who came down had never even been to Montreal. They had not been to their own cities. So to come down to a city like Manchester or Nashua or wherever in New Hampshire, it was a real culture shock. And yet, because conditions were better here, this is why they stayed. Had they not been better, they would have gone back for good. So I'm not trying to romanticize the farm. I'm just trying to point out differences.
Paula, thank you so much for that call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's take one more call before we take our next break. This is Matthew calling from Deerfield. Hi, Matthew. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. I don't know if I just lost you or not, but
we're still here.
Oh, great. My question for the guest is, I know that there's a lot of touching on the previous caller who talked about how French last names aren't really pronounced very French anymore. And I was just wondering if the guest saw any parallels with the Hispanic groups that are currently in New Hampshire, and whether or not he thinks that, you know, maybe in 100 years the great-grandkids of today's Hispanic immigrants are going to be learning Spanish as a second language, not knowing how to pronounce their own last names.
Well, Matthew, I can't really predict the future, but I can tell you one thing, that the Hispanic people coming here today are coming in a much more open atmosphere where people, I think, are favoring the idea of cultural heritage. In the early days when the French Canadians first started coming, as well as others, the Polish, the Russians, the Greeks, and others were coming, they were told immediately, stop speaking that foreign language and assimilate right away. And today, I think we're much more open. It's true that there are movements, you know, the English-only movement and English first and that sort of thing. But I think the Hispanic people are coming into a much more open society, much more open to, multilingualism and all. And so it's quite possible that they could continue, but I really can't predict the future.
Matthew, thank you so much for that call. The exchange number again, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And picking up on the idea of language, there have been periods in the past where you would see a sort of an Americanization movement, and you write about a few of those. And how did the Franco-American communities in New Hampshire react to that? Did they stick with La Survivance?
I think it depends on the individual and the family, if you want. It was a challenge to them. The minute you're told speak English only, right away they want to speak more French than ever. Others perhaps reacted quite the opposite, and then others just kind of went with the flow, you know? I think the majority probably just went with the flow.
We'll talk more about the history of Franco-Americans in New Hampshire after a short break. We'll also take more of your calls and emails. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Today on Word of Mouth, the startling effects of light pollution, from a billion bird collisions to potential links between exposure to light and cancer rates. And black women and guns. A journalist joins the fast-growing number of African-American women packing heat. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth puts new ideas in the crosshairs today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings, on time, on budget, online at northbranch.net. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Ethical Chic. We talk with the author of a new book on companies we often think of as more ethical and whether or not that's always the case. Email us your thoughts to exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with Franco-American scholar Robert Perot about the history of French Canadians in the Granite State. Arguably, no other culture has had as much of an influence on New Hampshire as Franco-Americans. We'll look at why they came, where they've settled, and the idea of la survivance, which kept their culture alive and well in cities like Manchester, Nashua, and Berlin. Robert, by the way, is giving a talk on the Amiskik textile worker tonight in Wakefield. It's part of the New Hampshire Humanities Council's Humanities to Go series. You can find more information at our website, nhpr.org. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment on today's show, call us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Robert, just before the break, we were talking about the parallels perhaps between the Franco-American experience and other cultures. And I did want to ask, because I know that in the mills, we're not only talking about Franco-American workers, that there were often many different people from different backgrounds who sometimes spoke different languages. And I'm curious, where did people work well together? And then where was there tension between Franco-Americans and perhaps people from other backgrounds?
Well, first of all, I should mention, in 1916, a journalist came and spent a week in the Amiskig Mills just interviewing people. And at the end, he revealed that he had heard 28 different languages spoken in the mills. Okay, so what they did, they tended to do, was to have certain jobs and certain rooms designated for certain ethnic groups when they realized that It would be better to have people of the same language working together. If they don't understand one another, it's difficult. So you might have a Greek carding room and a French weave room and a Polish spinning room or whatever, you know. And so, and with, obviously, with secondhand, who could control, quote unquote, his own people, his or her own people. So that's pretty much how they got around it. So,
But was there tension between some of the ethnic communities in, say, Manchester?
Well, certainly the French and the Irish, there was a lot of tension. In fact, I have another chapter in the book about that, because people keep asking me every time I speak in public, what's that French-Irish thing? Could you explain it? And I say, well, that's another talk. So I wrote a chapter on it to explain it. First of all, you have to understand that when the Irish Catholics first came in the 1840s after the potato famine in Ireland, they were attacked by Protestants, the Know-Nothing movement, you know, that whole Americanization movement, that where they actually sometimes burned, they went as far as burning churches and convents and that sort of thing. And this was going on throughout the Eastern Seaboard, by the way. Manchester had its riots, a few riots and attacks on homes and whatnot. So the Irish felt vulnerable, so they wanted to Americanize themselves as quickly as possible. Now, they already spoke English, so they didn't have that problem. They had an Irish accent, but other than that, there wasn't a linguistic problem. But then when the other ethnic groups began coming in, especially Catholics, the Irish wanted those ethnic groups to become American as well. And in the Catholic Church hierarchy wanted to have a very strong Catholic Church. And so you got all these French Canadians coming in from the north speaking French with the whole survivance ideology, saying, no, we're going to resist. Obviously, there was going to be tension there at church. And so the French Canadians demanded their own parishes where they could be preached to in their own language. Latin was the language of the mass and the ritual, but the preaching and confessions as well was done in French. Now, there was the other front, and that was at work, where the Irish had fought very hard for good conditions and for better pay. The French Canadians came in, and they were willing, they were just so happy to have a job, they were willing to take whatever job it was, whatever pay, and so that created tension between the French and the Irish, because the Irish would have wanted the French to join them and, you know, fight for better conditions. And I can remember, even that same idea, even in grammar school, I can remember nuns telling us, if life doesn't give out the gifts that you want or the goals, you don't reach your goals or whatever, don't worry. You'll die someday and you'll go to heaven, so offer it up to God. And that whole idea was I think, prevalent then among the workers. I think they just, well, take whatever life gives you and deal with it. And the Irish just didn't believe in that. They fought for better conditions.
And yet, so, despite that tension, as you point out in the book, there's actually some common heritage, because there were some people who came from Ireland to Quebec and then wound up coming down to New Hampshire.
That's absolutely right. It was actually less expensive to go from Ireland over to Canada than from Ireland to the United States. So they would usually go to Halifax. And of course, the Irish and the English didn't get along. So they would leave those provinces and go over to Quebec, where they got along very well with the French Canadians, and they themselves assimilated, just the same way that, you know, we say our French Canadians have assimilated over the years. Well, the Irish were assimilating then. So you had people with names like O'Toole and Murphy, who after two or three generations were speaking only French, didn't speak a word of English. So when they came down here to New England, they were coming here with Irish names, but they were speaking French.
Let's take another call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. This is Suzanne calling from Berlin. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the exchange.
Hi there. I wanted to address the school system, the parochial school system. I went to school in the late 50s, early 60s with French nuns, and they were extremely, extremely strict. And I dare say that if the same things that went on back then were happening now, those ladies would have been in legal trouble as far as discipline was concerned. You know, hitting kids, and the priest, of course, just ruled with an iron hand. Here my parents were adults, and if you, you know, tried to maybe, you know, put a kid in public school, or if you even had any kind of discussion, that was shut down immediately. So I'm wondering if Mr. Perro had any experiences where the nuns were, you know, they taught well. You certainly learned what you needed to learn, but there was a great deal of abuse.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Yeah. Thank you, Suzanne.
Well, Suzanne, I can tell you right now, I went to school at the same time as you, late 50s and early 60s. And yes, I did see that sort of thing. Corporal punishment in those days did exist in the Catholic schools. And I can even remember some of my friends in the neighborhood I lived in, because I did not live in a little Canada. So some of my friends from the neighborhood went to public schools, and they would say things like, teachers can't even touch us. They're not allowed to touch us. How come you guys get slapped around? And I can remember my parents saying, well, if you get slapped around, it's because you deserve it. That was the way, that was the thinking in those days. And so that's what it was. And I can tell you, we were in our grammar school, there were two classes, like two first grades, two second grades, two third grades. And we started out with 40 children in each of those grades. One nun could handle 40 children without a teacher's aid, and those kids, because we were scared to death. You know, it really was. I mean, it was a great education as far as getting the transferring knowledge to us, but at the same time, from a social standpoint, it was scary. It was pretty frightening. But then I gotta say, certain nuns were stricter than others. There were some nuns who were very kind and who would never touch you, and others who just, you know, they were just sadists, and they just enjoyed ridiculing you or, you know, slapping you around or whatever.
And Suzanne's other point was talking about the role of the priest and how central that was in a tight-knit community, that the priest knew what was going on with families and individuals and was not shy about speaking up about that.
Yeah, priests, perhaps not so much in the 50s and 60s, but certainly in the earlier days, priests ruled families. I mean, the priest was not just your spiritual guide. Your priest was also he could be your financial advisor, your educational advisor, your everything, your marriage counselor. You didn't sneeze without consulting your priest to find out what he thought. That, I think, that idea deteriorated over the years, so that by the time I came along, I think they were respected. But like my parents never consulted a priest. One time my mother did, because one of my cousins was going to marry a Protestant, and we were invited to the wedding. And in those days, if you're a Catholic, you're not supposed to go to a Protestant wedding. And so my mother went to see the priest to ask him, and he goes, well, you know, that's up to your conscience. But in the early days, they just said, no way are you going to go to that wedding. And we ended up not going. So,
Suzanne, thank you so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. I wanted to share this comment from our Facebook page. This is from Cammy, and Cammy writes, three of my grandparents were French-Canadian, and we grew up hearing Quebecois French spoken among the older generations. In fact, my mother's family all spoke French at home and had to learn English at school. They were all raised in Suncook. My generation didn't learn the language beyond a few phrases and choice curse words, which I regret. I'm very proud of my heritage and wish that I had more than just a handful of recipes. Pork pie, tarte au sucre, I'm sorry, I'm butchering the pronunciation here, pudding chumeur to link me to it. So a couple of points here. One is coming back to that idea of the language and how central that is, but also the issue of food, which we haven't touched on this hour.
Well, I hear that all the time. But first of all, the regrets that people have. You know, it's funny. It's a two-way street because on the one hand, there are people who say, oh, they drum that French into me and I'm so sick and tired of it. And yet if you don't have it, then you regret not having it. So it's kind of, you know, and we raised our son, my wife and I raised our son in French. He's now almost 30 years old and he's raising his daughter who's 16 months old today, and he's raising her to speak French as well, and we babysit her, so we speak French all the time. As far as food is concerned, yes, we have many delicacies that we've brought down from the, it's very farm food, you know, tourtière, which is pork pie, and we have creton or gorton, whichever, which is a pork spread. You can see the, you know, why there's so many heart attacks. By the way, poutine, which they pronounce poutine, and you can get it at Chez Vachon in Manchester, is not a traditional Franco-American or Quebecois food. That's something that was invented probably about 30 years ago. It's very new. And, you know, the French fries with curd cheese and gravy, which is I call a heart attack on a plate, but it's good.
it's a good way to go if you gotta.
Yeah.
Coming back to the idea that Cammie brought up of the regrets about the language, I mean, I've talked with a few people who are longtime Manchester residents, and they said that, you know, for some people, even into the 50s and 60s, you could, with some effort, get by speaking only French and no English, or at least very little English. Did there come a point when that stopped being the case?
I think it was something gradual. First of all, as I said, you put a little bit more, with every generation, a little bit more English water in your, or American water in your French wine. But it accelerated, I'd say, in the 70s and 80s and so on, because the French parochial schools closed. That whole system closed. And so parents, I think, because they didn't prepare their children to speak French. Like when I was a kid, you, in order to get into those schools, you had to be perfectly bilingual in French and English. And so when those schools closed, the parents no longer had the need to speak French to their kids. And a lot of times, I think when the parents would speak French and kids would answer back in English, it became like a gradual thing to, rather than say, no, no, if you want supper, you're going to speak French. It created a lot of tension. And so now we resisted that. My wife and I resisted that. And I think our son is happy today because, he, like I say, he's raising his daughter to speak French as well.
One thing we see now, we still see people coming from other parts of the world to New Hampshire. And many of them are coming from countries in, say, West Africa, where there are links to French culture. There's the language is there. There are perhaps colonial ties to France. And it'll be interesting to see if there are any parallels between their experience and Franco-Americans.
I think they, and I've said this before, they, if they can, they've got the power. They're at the point where our people, Franco-Americans, were 100 years ago. They've got the power to make that decision to pass the language on and the culture. And it's something that's free. You know, people, I teach French at St. Anselm College, and people are paying a lot of money to learn a language, whereas you've got it. If you've got it and you can pass it on, and that's for any language. That's not just for French. It's for any language. It's a gift that you give to your children and your grandchildren. It's not that difficult, and it doesn't really take that much effort. It seems like it does, but once you get into it, it's something very, very simple.
That sounds like La Sauvivance will be with us for some time still to come.
Well, in my family, it will.
Well, Robert Perot, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Robert Perot is a writer, historian, and French teacher at St. Anselm College. His new book is Franco-American Life and Culture in Manchester, New Hampshire, Vivre la Difference. You can find out more about his book and continue the conversation at our website, nhpr.org. While you're there, you can also hear about Robert's talk tonight at the Amiskig Textile Worker, about the Amiskig Textile Worker tonight in Wakefield. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Tim Camerato. The Exchange music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, conscientious consumerism. The author of the new book, Ethical Chic, says companies and consumers can have a hard time when it comes to being socially responsible. There are uncomfortable trade-offs. It's nearly impossible to fulfill every ideal. Some want to appear socially responsible, even if they don't always live up to the ideals. And there's the need to make a profit, even if you're eco-friendly. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.